chairs and bear with me, see if we've got the right lineup here. The next case on the call is Saylor versus State of Nebraska, 22-822. The following justices are recused in the matter. I'm making a record. This doesn't sound boring. Chief Justice is recused, Justice Papik is recused, and Justice Frydenberg is recused. Madam Bailiff, is that what your understanding is?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, then we are ready to go, and Mr. Barber, you can proceed. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. My name is Joshua Barber. May it please the court, opposing counsel. I represent James Saylor. This case involves two separate actions, two separate cases that were filed in the District Court of Lancaster County. I'll refer to the first of those two cases as Saylor 1. I'll refer to the second of those two cases as Saylor 2. And that is how those cases were referred to throughout the briefing in this case as well. Mr. Saylor is asking for this court to reverse the District Court's order in Saylor 2, which granted the state defendant's motion for judgment on the pleadings, and to remand the case for further proceedings on his third amended complaint in Saylor 2. At the heart of our, the main argument that we raise is that the court erred by finding that Saylor 2 was barred by the doctrine of claim preclusion. There are two reasons why this was incorrect. The first reason is that Saylor 1 and Saylor 2, the claims in each of those two cases arose out of different sets of operative facts. The claims in Saylor 1 ended September 14th. The facts underlying the claims in Saylor 1 ended September 14th of 2012. That case was dismissed by this court on statute of limitations grounds. And in Saylor 1, the state defendants argued that Saylor's claim was late in that case based on that end date of the facts underlying Saylor 1. The facts underlying Saylor 2, based on what's alleged in the third amended complaint and the tort claims which are attached and incorporated by reference into the third amended complaint in Saylor 2, the underlying facts for those claims began in June of 2014 and continued, I believe, to a period of time in 2017. There were a number of, I believe, 16 different tort claims that Mr. Saylor filed, which were incorporated into Saylor 2. So the first reason that the district court's decision was wrong was because the claims in Saylor 1 were based on a separate set of facts than the facts that the claims in Saylor 2 were based on. So the judgment dismissing the claims in Saylor 1 could have no preclusive effect on the claims in Saylor 2. To the extent that there was any overlap in the facts which underlied the claims in the two cases, we would suggest that the claims are also not precluded in Saylor 2 because the parties acquiesced or agreed to proceed while there were two actions pending at the same time that involved Mr. Saylor's claims. It's laid out in a lot of detail in the briefs. Saylor 1 was filed, then Saylor 2 was filed. Both Saylor 1 and Saylor 2 were pending for a period of time before there was any adjudication on the merits of either case. So before the state defendants filed motions to dismiss in either Saylor 1 or Saylor 2, the state had filed a motion to consolidate the two proceedings. And that motion was based on, and I'm summarizing, but essentially it was for judicial efficiency. The motion to consolidate was ruled upon and was granted, and there was a judge's note.
Granted in what respect?
Well, as to proceedings and trial, the cases were consolidated. And so they were before two separate judges to begin with. As a result of the ruling on the motion to consolidate, the cases were then before the same judge and for purposes of trial, based on the ruling that the district judge made, those cases would be tried together. So at that point, there wouldn't have been, other than giving the cases the same case number, I suppose, and requiring Mr. Saylor to merge all of his claims into one pleading, there was nothing further to do that could have made the proceedings for these cases more efficient.
Didn't that ruling expressly keep the pleadings separate?
Well, I think the ruling expressly kept the pleadings separate, but I don't think that changes whether or not the parties agreed or acquiesced to proceed with two simultaneous cases on these claims. Mr. Saylor had brought all of the claims as soon as he was able. The vehicle that was used, or I should say the vehicles that were used, were two separate complaints. Hindsight's 20/20, and perhaps a better procedure might have been to move to amend the complaint in the first case or move to supplement the complaint in Saylor 1 with the later claims. That's not the path that was chosen in light of the fact that the motion to consolidate was filed. Our argument is that that would have been of no effect to do that other than give the cases the same case number. It would have, the cases would have proceeded toward trial in the same fashion. And so we suggest that the court should reverse this decision of the district court and remand for further proceedings on Saylor 2. Unless there are any further questions, I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time.
I have a question, and maybe I'm drilling down prematurely, but is it Mr. Saylor's position we have continuing torts over a period of time?
I think that
in
was
the search for time bar, day one, and what's been ruled on and so forth.
There, especially in the complaint that was filed in Saylor 2, there was language asserting a continuing conduct theory of recovery based on the claims that were attached to that complaint. The third amended complaint does not include the same language, and I think I would say that there is still a continuing conduct theory there, but as far as whether or not the allegations of fact in the third amended complaint reach back before September 14th of 2012, I don't think they do.
Thank you.
And if there are no further questions, I'd reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Morning, may it please the court. Eric Hamilton for the appellees. The district court correctly held that the judgment entered in Mr. Saylor's first lawsuit precluded his later relitigation of a substantially similar claim. Mr. Saylor argues that the district court erred because the tort claims form that he filed under Saylor 2 were still pending with the claims board when Saylor 1 was filed. But under Nebraska law, a negligence claim accrues when the act or omission occurs. Here, the acts or omissions underlying Mr. Saylor's negligence claim all happened before Saylor 1 was on file. None of the cases that Mr. Saylor cites establish the rule he urges that pre-suit requirements must be met before a negligence claim accrues. Mr. Saylor's reply brief raises two new arguments: that his negligence claim in Saylor 2 isn't really about just his medical health care, and that the state acquiesced in his claim splitting. Those arguments are forfeited. Neither argument appears in Mr. Saylor's opening brief, and Mr. Saylor made neither argument in the district court. In fact, the district court's order at the very end notes that Mr. Saylor did not argue acquiescence. Returning to the argument properly before this court, the Saylor 2 negligence claim had accrued by the time Saylor 1 was on file. We know that because the Saylor 2 complaint contains no facts occurring after Saylor 1 was filed, nor do the 16 tort claim forms attached to Mr. Saylor's Saylor 2 complaint, nor could they have. All of those tort claim forms were on file with the claims board at the time Saylor 1 was on file. There is timing overlap between the allegations in Saylor 1 and Saylor 2. Saylor 1 went all the way up to the time the amended complaint was filed, which is May of 2018. The Saylor 1 amended complaint says DCS has failed to provide plaintiff with adequate health and medical care from 2009 through the present. An amended complaint is Exhibit 36, and what I just read is page 13 there. It also says DCS has continually and negligently exposed plaintiff to intolerable conditions since 2010. And the amended complaint in Saylor 1 alleges that 9 individual defendants have caused and, quote, will continue to cause in the future damages and injuries, and that the state is responsible for its agents' actions. Now, at the same time, Saylor 2 goes back to at least 2010. The Saylor 2 complaint, the only date appearing in the third amended complaint in connection with facts is 2010. The third amended complaint says, since September 14th, 2010, the plaintiff has been exclusively or almost exclusively housed in segregation. Now, turning to the test that this court applies for the similarity between facts, just earlier this month, this court said in the Boone River case that claim preclusion is going to apply when the two claims at issue rely on the same basic facts. And we have that here when the third amended complaint in Saylor 2 is compared to the amended complaint in Saylor 1. Both of those complaints allege that Mr. Saylor suffers from PTSD, and from that PTSD, he's experienced anxiety, flashbacks, extreme fear, panic attacks, and inability to concentrate. Both complaints allege that Mr. Saylor's PTSD requires ongoing medical care and treatment. Both complaints allege that the judgment he won against the state put the state on notice of his health care and housing needs. Both complaints allege that Mr. Saylor has almost exclusively been in administrative segregation since September of 2010. Both say that the state is required to provide him a community standard of health care. And as a chart in our brief, this is pages 20 to 22 of our brief, lays out, both complaints rely on substantially the same theory of negligence, that the state has not provided him the right mental health care. The state has not provided him the right medication. The state has not provided continuity in care, and that he has not received proper housing. Unless the court has any questions, we would request that this court would affirm the district court's dismissal. No? Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. Yep. Do we have some time left?
Yes, Your Honor, 2 minutes, 20 seconds.
Ms. Carver, thank you.
With respect to the state defendant's assertion that Mr. Saylor forfeited the acquiescence and agreement argument, we disagree with that. Mr. Saylor did raise the acquiescence agreement argument at the trial court level in effect. I wrote one of the briefs for that case. I didn't use the word agree or acquiesce. I should have. But in the record, it's at page 70 it's page 587 of the transcript. It's a short supplemental brief in opposition to the motion for judgment on the pleadings. And in the first section, I think it's a two-page brief, I did argue with respect to the motion to consolidate having been filed and with the state being fully aware and choosing to proceed with the cases in that fashion, up to the point of filing motions to dismiss in both cases. So I think we did raise that argument at the district court level. I think the district court probably either missed that or disagreed with it because Judge Ott, at the end of his order, made reference to the agreement acquiescence exception to the claim preclusion rule. But it's our position that argument falls beneath the greater argument, which is that claim preclusion does not apply in this case. So to the extent that the agreement acquiescence argument was not articulated in our opening brief before this court, we suggest that it falls under the umbrella of that larger assignment of error that claim preclusion does not apply, and our more pointed argument in the reply was simply intended to flesh that out. One other point. The state can't deny Mr. Saylor health care one time and then 2 years later deny him the health care again. And if he sues on the first time and loses, he's precluded from suing on the second time that they deny him, particularly if there is a period of years between the two separate sets of facts. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Council, you're all excused. Thank you.